ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Lauren Zelaznik, Senior Advisor and Board Director at Refinery29, the first female board member of GoPro, board member at Shazam, Nielsen, and formerly Penguin. She's a Senior Advisor for Boston Consulting Group, a trustee at Brown University, an adjunct professor at NYU, and an angel investor. She has devoted her career in media to changing the cultural landscape, from her early beginnings as an independent award-winning feature film producer to roles such as EVP at NBC Universal and president of Bravo. Every week, Lauren also publishes a widely read and influential newsletter about women in business and culture, the LZ Sunday Paper. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
In a Fortune article from a few years back, you indicated that you thought that great media companies of the past would be joined by great media companies of the future, but that the middle would suffer. And nobody ever really fancies themselves to be in the middle. What would you classify as that middle space, the danger zone?
I think the danger zone in today's media landscape, the great middle, comes in two forms. I think that, well documented, the landscape is very tough for independent cable, either standalone networks or even mid-sized cable conglomerates that don't have a larger corporate parent. So that's a big middle ground.
Right.
I think similarly in the digital content, digital media landscape, the companies that hover around between $50 and $80 million, struggling to get to that $100 million revenue mark, whether or not they're cash flow positive, I think are at high risk because not only are they independent, but growth is very tough and they're simply in the middle of a very crowded landscape. And then I think if you look around, you can apply it to small to mid-sized independent agencies that haven't already been bought, small to middle, independently owned, or even conglomerate newspaper chains, traditional broadcast companies. It's a tough time to be alone out there, and that's the great middle. The flip side is that even very big outlets. In the history of television, the broadcasters were successful, super performing for the great middle. The more people,
right,
the blander, the better. I think the risk today is networks that were once making their bread and butter under the catchphrase for everybody, now run the risk of actually being for nobody.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I wonder, you know, because even the very large agencies like WPP are running into all kinds of trouble. One of the other things that you had said in an interview, again, a ways back, but very prescient, was that the one piece of advice you would give is not to underestimate the growing power of digital media and how it can fuel traditional media's success. And do you believe that traditional media has heeded that advice and used digital to their best advantage?
I think there's plenty of examples. I think probably at the time, you know, AOL Time Warner was still in enough of the rearview mirror that that was an unsuccessful attempt, and I was still very optimistic about the next iteration of that. I think there's plenty of naysayers that say, hey, it still hasn't worked. I think where I feel today the strength lies is, I don't want to be stuck on it, and it's hard to point to the most successful examples yet, but big traditional media companies, whether it's by ubiquitous distribution or ways to reach the audiences that are going to fuel their sustenance for the future, absolutely have to figure out how to engage with, partner with, JV with, or acquire the right digital content companies to fuel their audience sustenance.
Right.
I think conversely, enough couple years have elapsed where we now see the biggest digital platforms, I won't yet call them media companies, kind of going the other way. And with the rise of original programming on all of the platforms, whether acquired like sports programming on Twitter or acquired original programming like on Facebook, like, you know, the rise of the thing called stories, just the fact that they're called stories on Snap and Instagram, the blend is going to happen. And I think some will be successful, some will not, but the blend is going to happen both ways. Digital right. to traditional, traditional to digital.
I'm curious, the revenue models, you know, especially when we're talking about some of the earlier in the conversation, talking about the digital companies that were trying to grow, you know, the 50 to 80 million pocket. What do you think the successful revenue model is? Is it subscription? Is it ads? Is it a blend? You know, especially given the sort of ad duopoly with Google and Facebook.
Yeah. Again, you know, it's going to be really easy to poke holes in every kind of argument. So the way I look at it is things are always true or never true until they're sometimes true.
Ha, good point.
And, you know, you have a 100% subscription model that loses a ton of money and it's the hottest stock and the most coveted place to consume, watch, sell, or work. It's Netflix. Mm. It's all subscription. That was supposed to be, you know, not the right strategy. We have a number of strategies happening across the traditional media companies going over the top, banking on subscription for the future. They have a big cash cow making a tremendously healthy margin. Mm. Yet that value doesn't hold in the public markets, meaning, you know, stocks can get hammered for not showing enough growth, even though not only the top line is there in the 10 billion plus revenue line with a very healthy margin, because there are constraints on growth, those big media company stocks are sometimes punished. So there's an uneven playing field between new companies fueled by growth losing a ton of money versus more traditional companies that have an immense cash reserve, immense guaranteed revenue for the future, but it may be under threat. They are unduly punished. I think what is rewarded today are multiple streams of growth, particularly in the digitally focused non-duopoly, not Facebook, not Google, digital media companies, because I think portfolio strategies work.
Right.
And if you can figure out your ad-based model and get to that $100 million mark, if you can add to that some kind of subscription model, it right. could be, I don't think everyone should invent a box and send a physical box to your house, because I'm not sure that's the answer. But some kind of commerce element seems to be compelling for consumers, seems to be compelling for investors. I think podcasting, like where you and I are right this second, there's something really important about the rise of audio, and people are responding to that. And most of all, this interesting strand around IRL, in real life, live events.
Yes.
Digital content companies who manage to pull people together off the virtual platform into a real place with real other people. Those are kind of like the four pillars that I think can work.
Yeah. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Do you think that one of the things, Leora Kornfeld reported that 2/3 of revenue in the music industry right now is from streaming. And do you think that that's just going to, that it, the movement is going to be to have everything streamed in video, that this is just coming? I mean, there's a certain amount, every day or at least every week, I will read an article of, you know, no, it's not going to happen. Yes, it is going to happen. Where do you fall on the future of linear TV viewing?
I think the difference between the music industry and the visual industry is such that there was a collapse of the physical product, records, and then the things called CDs. Mm-hmm. I think that in the evolution of the music industry, it started as a singles industry. you know, 45s, A right. side, B side. There was a very brief, again, in the short history of the consumer-driven music industry, a brief little blip called the age of the album, right?
Oh, and yeah, that awesome time.
It was super awesome and very heavy to lug around, you know, college dorm rooms and you know, first apartments and stuff. But it was a moment, a decade or two decades. And then the age of rights management and streaming kind of took that away. And now we're back to sort of this singles era with plus an algorithm, plus an amazing interface. Okay.
Right.
The parallel to the TV and movie industry is the rise of VHS and DVD, and then that collapsing and being a streaming avenue.
Right.
And if you think about it, Netflix's rise was not from zero to 50 million subs. They built a platform of, you know, 15 million addresses
right.
and automatic payments through physical goods, through physical
right.
DVDs.
Right.
And
that's true.
Yep. So it wasn't a start from scratch. It was a long history of commerce around pre-produced material. And of course, the original, you know, streaming service was the replacement of the DVD mailer.
Right. Oh, you know, it's funny because of course that's true, but you forget, certainly forget.
Then I think the confluence into the world of TV was such that it really was not a move from linear to streaming. It was a move from linear to time shifting through the DVR, which replaced VHS.
Ah, right. Okay.
Right. So you replaced your hit record and play at the same time on your VHS player because you could never really record TV to DVD.
Right.
So you had these VHSs, then both of the two things, VHS for TV recording collapsed because of the advent of the DVR. DVDs collapsed because of the advent of movie streaming, not TV streaming. And then the confluence of Netflix with a high cash bounty for old TV that had been written down in libraries became valuable again. So that was not given away, but sold for high value, but a dependent relationship happened. And then place shifting happened simultaneously. So the DVR was time shifting. The mobile and social revolution of smartphones was place shifting. And then the final sort of dismantling, you know, the game where you pull things out until everything.
Oh yeah, Jenga.
Jenga. Right. Or the ripoff form that I had for my kids, which was called Tumbling Monkeys, now that I think about it, and you pull these sticks out and then all monkeys fall out of their palm tree. But anyway, the final peg coming out of this pegboard was the confluence of traditional media selling for very high value, previously sub-value catalog, place shifting in the form of mobile and social through smartphone viewing, time shifting through the form of DVR and an attempt by the cable companies to keep up with on-demand platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Then the real that was all a Trojan horse for original programming on the streaming platforms.
Right, because then once you have it set up, then you can launch this other thing.
Yep.
Oh, I like how you set that out. I think I'm going to borrow it.
not that I've thought about it very much at all or anything.
Just a bit. You know, changing gears a little bit, you did a TED Talk and you put forward the argument that TV had a conscience and that it was almost a mirror of our national psyche. And I thought that was a really fascinating thing, especially given what we've seen lately with social media and the ways in which algorithms distort and magnify people's leanings. Do you believe that social media has a conscience?
In the way that I defined it in that TED Talk, yes. I think that it's the very...
It's almost like a grotesque version, though, right? I mean, it seems...
Well, the definition of conscience that I meant was that the behaviors which you can pass a judgment on, like It's not nice. It's gross. It's great. It's democratization. It's mob mentality. Whatever words you want to put on it, I think that the behaviors belie an emotional need state of different affinities in the country. And that the whether they're economic indicators, social indicators, intellectual trends, all kinds of inputs, I think there are overwhelming needs fulfilled by different parts of social media. I think that if you look at anger is not a motivator. What people are angry about, those are motivators. Those are needs that people have. And the way they're fulfilled is through this behavior. I think if you look at the more benign forms or even the heroic forms of some parts of social media, the world of Upworthy started as an antidote, as a feel-good story. You know, if you smile, the person next to you is going to, you know, X percent more likely to smile. That got turned inside out very quickly by copycatters, and even then another iteration of the you know, thing we now call generically clickbait.
Right.
And but the impulse was a good one to start. The impulse of closed Facebook groups, in my experience, is for people who, even as far back as my iVillage days, it was a safe, moderated environment for people, you know, in that experience, women, to talk about kids with a certain problem. And they were tough problems, man. It was to talk about, you know, today, you know, different affinities. You know, there's groups for women over 50. There's also groups for people who hate another group or another. But in other words, there's an emotional need that is filled by certain aspects of social media. I do think that in general, yes, there's a collective conscience, and people like to assign a positivity to the word conscience when I mean it as a broad spectrum of emotional needs that get satisfied one way or another. When there's a vacuum, the vacuum gets filled by the first thing that comes to them. And we've seen that over and over again in the media world.
Right. There's been recently some talk about regulating social platforms, also even just regulating the web. With social platforms, you know, publishers should be paying for news content. With the web itself, that some of these very powerful players maybe shouldn't have so much power because it's stifling creativity. Usually when I think about regulation, I think that it's, you know, governmentally done and somewhat ham-handed and doesn't usually work. But I'm curious what your opinions are on regulation, no regulation in general for the web. And then looking at social platforms, should they be paying publishers for news or entertainment content?
That's a big, big topic. I mean, so, you know, obviously, it's big because the word publisher is, it's a tough one. The word platform, you know, the New York Times is a publisher and they pay people to create content that they choose to publish.
Well, I guess, yeah, I guess I should rephrase it.
You know, it's really
sort of traditional news outlets and also traditional entertainment outlets who are creating that people, for instance, people subscribe online to newspapers, but sometimes you run across an article and it's from the Sacramento Bee and you're not a subscriber to the Sacramento Bee. You're unlikely to be, but you'd like to be able to read that one article. And is, you know, and obviously micropayments are tricky, but if there was some sort of thing that if I'm in my social media that I can get all of this news, but these people are compensated so that then the people who write these articles get paid, blah, blah, blah. You know, things like
right. Yeah. I think the broader question is the whole world of the original digital promise was dominated in the 90s, pre-bust, you know, 2000-ish. Right. The word was disintermediation. That was the holy grail, that you could publish anything, that I could read anything, that everyone had the same exact access to everything else. And what it turned out to be in the bust and then the re-rise of digital post 2001, let's say, is that once again, intermediation is the place where all of the value is. There is zero value in disintermediated, ubiquitous content. And so if you look at it as a series of gatekeepers, those gatekeepers live on the other side of your cable box. Those gatekeepers live on the other side of the Columbia Record Club of the 1970s. Those gatekeepers live behind the, you know, attractive office parks of our favorite social media campuses. And so I think three things come into play. You're going to pay one way or another to have access to the things you want to have access to. The issue of them determining what you have access to, it has been three-dimensionalized. Again, any newspaper in the world, any magazine in the world has picked the cover, has picked the upper right-hand story, has picked the front page photo, and you get it served to you, whether it's on your screen or on your doorstep, and that's their choice. The three-dimensionalization of it is what you talked explicitly about, which is that things through this thing called the algorithm have been consciously manipulated to drive people in a quicker cycle to their extreme than broadening out their view to have parity across a broader spectrum of information and entertainment. That's one dimension. The second dimension is that when you have a very particular job as a gatekeeper, if you're a gatekeeper on a production company side, your gate is, I make great stuff, you tell me who it's for, you pay me for that expertise, I deliver it to you. You don't, if you're a distributor of whatever sort, your authority is to deliver that information or entertainment content efficiently.
Right.
It's when you add this entire stem to stern, snout to tail, whatever you want to call it, the full picture of information control from inception to delivery, and you have a toll at every mile of that long, 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 long highway, that's when I think it gets complicated and not terrific for the consumer.
Switching gears again. Since leaving NBC, you've been pretty busy, I'd say.
That's one confrontation I've had to have with myself, which is, I guess I'm a person who likes to be busy. That's the bottom line. I don't know. I keep feeling like...
Seem like you're filling your time.
I'm filling my time. Yep.
And one of the ways that I've gotten to know you is through your LZ Sunday paper, which is a news aggregator of sorts. And for people who aren't familiar with it, can you share a bit about it and why you started it?
Yep. I do this thing called the LZ Sunday paper. I've done it since the very first Sunday I was not on the payroll anymore at NBC Universal. And what I do each Sunday is collect the 15, 12, 18, try never to go above 20 critical news stories of the week that I think are the most interesting and important takes on the news of the week about and very frequently by women. Not necessarily for women exclusively, but the focus is on women and their place in the week, in the world, across business, politics, media, education, sports, and pop culture. It started much more media focused, and it started because it grew out of an incredible group that we started called Women at NBC Universal, which was essentially a sales and marketing outreach to 15 or 20 important, powerful, I will use that word, thinkers in mostly marketing, research, sales, agency world. And it was a convened body, and we just tackled a topic that was common to the industry as professional women. How to speak to moms about cars, how to speak to independent single women who had spending power. It was a marketing challenge. We got together, we had expert insights, and that's what we did. When we left, I sort of really liked this newsletter that had grown out of that. And of course, it very quickly became a little broader. It became a little more personal because the first, 100 or so people I sent that first one to, I absolutely knew everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think what's really interesting about it is that at the very beginning, I got a lot of personal notes back. And it was very classic friends and female friends and peers who said, "Oh my gosh, I'm so excited you're doing this. I'm so glad. I feel really guilty." Like, why? "Well, I'm just worried that there's so much in my inbox. I'm worried about being overwhelmed. I'm worried about it coming on a Sunday. I'm worried that I'm not going to read it." All this worry. And so I started in the top note to say, like, "Hey, just so everybody who's getting this knows, it's no big deal. Like, hit delete, hit unsubscribe. It's no big deal. Read one, read none. No problem." And I think the most gratifying thing that has happened over the couple years is, yes, every unsubscribe is like, a stab wound to my gut. It's like, "Oh my God, they hate me," whatever. Okay. All right. That's a confession. But the positive side is that the growth is great. I love reaching more people. What's even more positive is that most of the people who I don't know, who email me a great piece they think I should see, or just want to tell me, like on, sports radio, longtime listener, first time caller, they email and say, "Hey, I don't know you, but I just want to tell you, so-and-so subscribed me. I really enjoy it. And it's the first thing I turn to on Sunday morning. It's my private 20 minutes before the Sunday Times, before my kids' breakfast, before my, spin class. This is my time. Thank you." And that's a big transformation from assuming you're going to be guilty, assuming you're going to be too busy, etc.
Right.
And the other thing I'll say is that when I started, which is 4 years ago now, it performed a different function. There was hardly any interesting information about women in business, women in culture, except the articles that were so-and-so on the women in whatever top 10 list, And so I had to go scraping around to find anything interesting that was slightly an acute angle into a major subject, but from this essential perspective. Mm-hmm. Now, the job I think has been really incredible is that there's so much information, a deluge of stories, of publications, of other great blogs, of other great news aggregators, that the curatorial has gone from collector to synthesizer.
Right.
And so that's been an interesting part of the journey as well.
Well, I think that's really where it's so important. I get so frustrated when the speaker at a conference will be a woman and she'll have this amazing role, like lead, engineer at Pinterest. And what is she talking about? She's talking about women.
Right.
And I really, it just sends me around the bend. And I debate with myself whether some of these groups are ghetto, create a ghetto of women. I went to a talk and it was lots of interesting data, but I thought, it's no good for us to be in this room. We need men in this room. They need to hear this information. So that leads nicely into the current Me Too moment. Does anything surprise you that you read these days?
No, but that's not a good question for me because I would say that I have an interest. Well, yeah, kind of like an interesting combination personality where I'm very sure that bad things are happening all the time. However, I'm kind of gullible and optimistic at the same time. So I don't know.
So it gets you coming and going.
It gets actually, you're 100% right. It gets me coming and going. So it's not great. But like, basically, I'm surprised every day that something horrendous hasn't happened. Like, so it's a good day when, you know, another World Trade Center doesn't fall down. I'm right. Like, hey, it's a good day. Like, if I walk by that giant crane and it doesn't fall on me, like, hey, that's good. Because I was just thinking, hey, that crane is probably going to fall on me. Like, so it is a little bit tough. I would say there's not that much that has surprised me, honest to God.
I guess I've gotten to the point where I guess anything that I have knowledge of, that field, then it doesn't surprise me. But I somehow believed that other fields that I hadn't been experienced in were somehow more noble than the ones I had worked in myself. So what do you know? I guess people are the same the world over.
I get what you mean. And certainly, you know, early in my career, first 10 years for me, I did not have a corporate job. I didn't have a real job until my 30s, you know, so yeah, on film sets, especially at that time, and even in corporate culture, you know, in the 90s, it was still in existence, you know, the idea of the titan, certainly artist, and the titan personality-driven CEO, that was still, you know, of the moment. At the same time, I actually, again, have thought and known most of my life that it's really the quotidian, the people who are really trapped, who really, really need the job, who, you know, from secretaries to bank tellers to waitresses to nurses to every other kind of industry, let alone the industries where, you know, as opposed to domestic work, et cetera, which is a horror, where you're breaking into an actual boys' club.
Right.
It's sports broadcasting or banking. It just had to be that way. There is no two ways about it. I guess the only surprise to me is that the difference between unacceptable cultural norms and pathological, disturbed, clinical behaviors
are more blended than we thought.
Yeah. Are more blended than we thought. That is a surprise.
Yeah, sometimes I'm like, he did what? Well, you know, I know you have a heart out and we have run right up into the edge of it. So I want to thank you so much for your time. I feel like
we can't end on that note.
Don't no, I know.
I want to question like, favorite flower or like, I don't know.
I have a game that I usually play with people, but I think,
What's the game?
The game is I read some words.
Uh-oh.
You give me your reaction. One word reaction. You want to play the game and then we'll end on that? Just one word, whatever comes to top of mind. First word is Facebook.
Okay, I told you I'm bad at games.
You're thinking too hard.
I'm thinking too hard. Just launched my LZ Sunday paper page, which was unduly complicated and 4 years too late.
Ah, Google.
Love it.
Snapchat.
Uncertain.
Twitter.
Huge potential.
YouTube.
The best of the best. People undervalue that content. Wish I could wave a magic wand and make it as awesome as it is.
Ad blockers.
Great idea. Useless.
Art.
Unknowable.
VR.
The 3D glasses of the 20 teens.
AR.
The VR of tomorrow.
AI.
Means different things to lots of different people. Absolutely going to be the fodder for scary movies for many decades to come.
And what are you watching? What are you binging?
The prior two movies of Ryan Coogler. The first season that I never saw in depth of Girls. The current season of Divorce, which was unfairly received critically, over and over and over, Wet Hot American Summer, and Veep. I feel like I'm missing the one I'm actually really, really, really watching right now.
I don't know how you could watch all this stuff with all this stuff that you have going on.
Well, sometimes I'm just mentally watching it in my head.
You mean you're not just purely thinking about the crane that's going to fall on you or anthropomorphizing those people who don't continue to subscribe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The pain. Well, I got better at the game as it went along. So that's good that I can still learn and be intimidated by things, but then get better at it by the end.
See, there you go. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
That is the end of our interview. So I appreciate your time.
Yep. And I'll see you in your inbox on Sunday.
Fantastic. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Lauren Zelaznik. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.